And that's been, throughout the whole day, has been a keen sense of Jesus in this place, in our hearts, as we have those conversations that are some of the defining parts of a conference like this, journeying through what it is to go deeper into discipleship. It's here, listening to Shane, being a part of these sessions. But then it's the car rides home and the conversations over lunch where we're dreaming and we're aspirational and then we're going, oh, I'm not entirely sure that I'm up to that. Those are all formative parts of this space and this time, and so I'd encourage you to embrace that. My job is to introduce Shane, and so I'm just going to hand the microphone to him and allow him to start speaking, and that hopefully will be introduction enough. We are incredibly grateful to have Shane here, and even the two sessions that we've had already have been very moving, and so why don't you come on up, Shane, and thanks for your ministry and time together.
Thanks, man.
It's great to be back together, and I've had a wonderful day. Got to see the sunset, go to the beach, went snorkeling with my mate Jared. It's a beautiful land you've got here. Don't take it for granted. I'm a long way from the beach in Philly, and it was snowing when I left home. Well, tonight we get to think a little bit about grace, and there's not much I get more excited to talk about. I heard someone once say that being a Christian is not just about having new ideas, it's about having new eyes. Kind of see people differently, see ourselves differently with grace. And I know when I first moved into Philadelphia, I was always praying for new eyes because I was like, I kept seeing a lot of things that I didn't see growing up. I saw a lot of pain and drug addiction and folks on the street. I lived kind of a sheltered life. And so when I started seeing some of that, some of it sort of threw me off, you know. And one of my first memories as we moved into Philadelphia was, in order to get to the store to buy food, we had to walk through the red light district. Like, it was one of our toughest avenues in Philadelphia. And so one day, as we were kind of walking to the store, one of the women on the avenue propositioned me, and I hadn't had that happen a lot. I just kind of felt really awkward, you know. I didn't know whether to just kind of ignore her or, you know, to talk to her. Either way, it still felt awkward, you know. And so I just kind of, we went on the store, got our food, came back to the house. And when we got back, we noticed that the bag of bread that I had picked out had a tear in the side, and all the bread was sort of moldy and crusty. And my housemate, she goes, "Oh, no worries. I got my I got the receipt. We'll just take it back and exchange it." And I'm like, "Awesome. That means we're gonna have to walk back, you know, the same way." So we did. We go back, and we're walking back, and we exchange a loaf of bread, no problem. But then on the way back, we saw that woman. And she was hunkered down in the alleyway, kind of shivering in the cold. And my friend and I knew that we couldn't just pass by, you know. So we go down in the alleyway, and we start talking to her. We bend down, and we could tell how cold she was. And we just said, "Hey, listen, if you need a place to come warm up, we've got a place around the corner. It's just a safe place. You know, if you need somebody to talk to, we got some folks that are, you know, there to just listening ears, you know, and if you're hungry, we got some good food, got some good bread going on, you know." And so she jumps up, follows us back to the house, and comes inside. And as soon as she gets in, she falls apart, you know, loses it, just starts crying. And my friend is just rocking her in her arms. And then as the woman sort of gathers herself, she looks up and says the strangest thing. She goes, "You guys are Christians, aren't you?" And we're like, "Whoa." Do a little t-shirt check. You know, I'm like, "Nope." And I'm like, you know, we don't have a sign outside flashing repent or burn. You know, I'm like, "How'd you know?" You know, and she goes, "I know because I can see it in your eyes." She said, "I used to be so in love with Jesus that I used to have that same fire in my eyes." She said, "I used to shine like the stars in the sky." And then she said, "But it's a cold, dark world. And it's nearly suffocated the light in me. It's killed the good in me, it feels like sometimes." She said, "I've lost my shine on these streets. And we you know, wrapped our arms around her and we prayed for her. We prayed that she would hear that whisper that we all need to hear, right? That we are beloved, beautiful, and that she would begin to feel that fire burn in her again. And she left that night, and we didn't know if we'd ever see her again. And weeks and weeks passed, and one night, quite late, there was a knock at the door, you know, and I didn't really think too much of it because we get a lot of knocks at the door, but I go to open the door, and this woman just jumps in my house. She's like, "Hey!" I'm like, "Whoa, do we know each other?" You know, and start there. And she goes, "Oh, yeah, you just don't recognize me. I'm a whole new woman. I'm shining again." When she said that, I knew who she was, you know, and she's talking 100 miles an hour. She says, "I'm in love with Jesus again. I got the fire burning." She said, "I wanted to just come back and say thanks, you know, for kind of meeting me where I was." And she said, "And I wanted to give you a little something." But then you could see her kind of backpedal almost apologetically, you know, and she said, "I got to say though, I pretty much left everything I had when I was living on the streets." And she said, "But I did smoke a lot of cigarettes." And she said, "And I always collected the sides of the cigarette boxes because you can trade them in for stuff." And she goes, "Hold on." She goes out to the car and she gets this shoebox that's just like, I can tell it's like boiling over with these coupons from the cigarette boxes. And she goes, "They're all yours." I'm like, awesome. You know, I'm thinking to myself, my mom's going to love it when I come home with a Marlboro hat, you know? But I came to find out they make really good page markers for your Bible. That's what I use them for. And every time I open up my Bible and I see my little Marlboro coupon, I'm reminded that we have a God that is loving people back to life. You know, that's what God does. And somehow we get to be a part of the fun, you know. And I was telling one of my friends that story that I just told you. And my buddy, he's one of those people that really likes to argue theology. You know those people, right? If you don't know those people, you are those people. You know, he's always arguing. So he goes, "Oh, you know, what I love about Jesus is he never really talked to a prostitute." And I'm like, "Oh, hold on, man." And I'm trying to see where he's going. You know, I got my Bible. I'm ready to throw down, you know. And he says, "No, listen." He says, "Jesus never talked to a prostitute because he didn't see a prostitute. He just saw a child that he was in love with, you know." And I told my buddy, "Okay, you win, but only this one time, you know." But I think that's, you know, it's what we're all learning, isn't it? Is kind of see people differently. And I don't know how we get it wrong. You know, we often are some of the most judgmental people. You know, we end up being some of the most self-righteous people if we're not careful. But I it's why I keep going back to Jesus. And I love the story with Jesus and the woman who's been caught in adultery, you know. I mean, the story starts, you know, difficult. But she's drug out before the town and humiliated, right? And all the guys are getting ready to stone her, you know, and arguably it was a capital crime. They had a right to do that. They're armed and ready. And Jesus just kind of interrupts the scene. It's awesome. The first thing he does is start digging in the dirt. It's weird. If you read the story, he says he goes in the circle of those armed men and he starts digging in the dirt. And we asked some of the kids, you know, "What's up with that? What do you think Jesus was writing in the dirt?" And one of the kids said, "Maybe he was writing, 'If this doesn't work, run, woman.'" My favorite answer right there. You know, we don't know what he was writing in the dirt, but we do know what he did next. And what he did next was beautiful. He looks at all the men. He says, "Let the one who is without sin cast the first stone." And of course, he'll remind them and all of us, right? If you've looked at someone with lust in your eyes, you've committed adultery. If you've called someone a fool, you've committed murder in your heart. And no one's above reproach and no one's beyond redemption. And I think that's the gospel, you know. And the stones start to fall and all the guys walk away. And the story's beautiful. It ends with Jesus and the woman. And Jesus goes, "Where'd they all go?" And you get the sense that the closer we are to God, the less we want to throw stones at other people. The only one who had any right to throw a stone had absolutely no desire. And that's what Jesus is like, right? And I think part of what why I got so involved with the death penalty in our country. And thankfully, you know, you're a civilized country. You've moved beyond it. But and just for the record, this is the company that we keep with the death penalty. Number one executing country in the world is China. And then you have Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. And so but what was even more troubling was that the death penalty wouldn't stand a chance in America if it weren't for the Christians. That literally where Christians are most concentrated in America is where the death penalty has survived. 86% of executions have been in the Bible Belt in the last 30 years. You look at that and it's so counterintuitive. So I've been, you know, raising questions about that and studying the scripture because there's a whole theological backbone to it. But at the end of the day, there's so many problems with it. I wrote this book, Executing Grace, and it's really about grace. Because I think at the end of the day, one of the most fundamental questions with the death penalty is this one. Is anybody beyond redemption? Right? Let me one of the stories that moved me, because it's the stories that moved me before, you know, I began to articulate my theology and everything else. But there's a guy named Billy Neil Moore I've gotten to know, and Billy's story starts very difficult. He was in the Vietnam War, came back from Vietnam very troubled in a lot of different ways. Not the least of which was financial. And so he and an army buddy after Vietnam, they came back and they came up with a plan to get some quick money. They understood it would be, you know, nothing would go wrong. It was an easy target. They were going to rob this house. And Billy, prior to this, had no criminal record at all. And so when they did this, everything went haywire and the homeowner was killed. And Billy was so haunted by what they did, he turned himself in, fully confessed to the crime. He knew that he would face the death penalty. I was in Georgia, and he said, frankly, that was fine with me. He said, if I could have pushed the button on my own execution, I would have done it. He wanted to die. He didn't know how he would live with what they did. So he tried to kill himself while he was in prison. And then in the middle of all that, there was an interruption. It came from what we might think was the unlikely place, but it was the victim's family. And they began a relationship with Billy, and they said, listen, we hate what you did. You took someone from us, and we will grieve that for the rest of our life. But we are followers of Jesus. We believe in grace. We believe in redemption. We know that the worst decision of our life doesn't have to hijack the rest of it, that we're all better than the worst things we've done. And so they said, we believe God has a future for you, and we're going to argue against the death penalty for you. Well, that moved him. You know, he began to understand grace and forgiveness in the gospel. He dedicated his life to Jesus, and he got baptized while he was in prison. And he's just awkward because they believed in full immersion, which is hard on death row. You know, and he said, but we kind of sweet-talked the warden, and they let him get this kind of pool, you know, and they created this baptismal inside the jail, and he's not a small fella, and so he laid down. They're like, okay, we're going to just grab your ankles and drag you through the tub, all right? So lean back, you know, and they're like pulling through. They're like, that's good enough, you know, and they baptized him. He dedicated his life to Jesus, and that family was one of the biggest advocates for his life. They actually became sort of his surrogate family, and in the end, I mean, it's a very, very exceptional case. Not only was his life spared, but he was released from prison, and today he's a pastor. And every chance I get, I preach with him, because every time he preaches, his message is no one is beyond redemption. And he is a living testimony of God's grace. That's what I love about this story, is that it is a scandalous kind of thing. You know, this gospel that God's love and God's grace is bigger than our mistakes. One of the things Billy says all the time is mercy triumphs over judgment. You know, that's one of the core tenets of our faith. And I don't know how we miss it, you know, because you go back to the Bible and you see, like, the Bible is full of messed up people, you know? Moses is one of the first murderers in the Bible. You know, he ends up killing this man, and burying him in the sand. Like David, who I learned in Sunday school, a man after God's own heart. On good days, you know, but he had, the brother had some bad ones, let me tell you. You know, like you read two chapters of the Bible and David breaks pretty much every one of the Ten Commandments. I mean, he just rips through them, you know? Like, he ends up committing lust, commits adultery, you know, takes someone else's wife. Some would say more accurately than adultery, it was actually rape, because it says that David looked at Bathsheba, wanted her, and took her. And then he ends up just, it continues to unravel, right? He lies about it. He ends up having her husband, Uriah, killed. So he hears the rebuke of God come from his friend Nathan. You know, he kind of goes into this time of repentance. You can see this, you know, long loneliness, this aching in his heart in so many of the Psalms. Because he goes on to write, you know, so many of the Psalms, the longest book of the Bible. And just for the record, when David did that, like, he already had like 7 wives and 10 concubines. I mean, how much is enough, right? I mean, the brother had a problem. He was a womanizer, right? And yet, like, he becomes one of the people that we, our story, right? He's in our story. In fact, if you look at the first chapter of the New Testament, it's really interesting because Matthew chapter 1 begins with the genealogy that leads up to Jesus, right? It's easy to skip those things, I know. You know, it's like, this was the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of, you know. But, like, it's kind of cool because if you look closely, it goes through and it gets to the David and Bathsheba thing. Look close. It goes, and then Solomon was born. Solomon was the son of David, but his mother was Uriah's wife. It's like, don't forget! That was messed up, right? But, like, God's grace is bigger than David's mistakes, and God's grace is bigger than our mistakes. The story unfolds like the family tree of Jesus had some messed up stuff going on in it, right? Because it's the story of humanity. It's the story of God's grace moving through the cracks of our broken lives. And so I love that. I love that Saul of Tarsus, who by every definition was a terrorist, right? I mean, talk about a religious extremist. He went door to door trying to kill Christians. He oversaw the execution of the first martyr of the church, Stephen, this young man, as it says that Saul oversaw the execution. And yet he gets knocked off his rocker, right? Blinded by the grace of God. He goes on to say, you know, write half the New Testament. He can say things like, chief of sinners am I, because he had done some stuff, right? So I think that's the scandal of grace. If we believe that a religious extremist, a terrorist, is beyond redemption, we can rip out half the New Testament. Because it was written by this man, Saul, who looked much of his life more like ISIS than a saint, right? We look at this story, and that's why I like Peter, too, because Peter's goofy. He's kind of, you know, he's got his rough edges. Because Peter, you know, who, like, he has walked with Jesus. He's heard the Sermon on the Mount from the man himself, and then the soldiers come. And, you know, the soldiers come, and Peter, still knee-jerk reaction, pick up the sword, cuts a dude's ear off, you know? I think the first thing Jesus did was say, Peter, work on your aim. Just kidding. You know, but Jesus scolds him. He says, put your sword back. And then he picks up the ear and pops it back on the guy, right? Heals him. And I think, my gosh, think of that guy's story that day, you know, as he goes home, has dinner with the family, you know, and like, kids, how's your day? Kids are like, oh, I got a lot of math homework, Dad. How's your day? Dad's like, weird. You know, this dude we came to arrest, one of his bros picked up a sword, cut my ear off, and then the guy we came to arrest put my ear back on. I mean, I think he'll tell that story a few times, right? Like, he was scarred by grace. Like, that was his story. And I think that's why it's like so interesting that Jesus chose Peter as the rock of the church. One of my friends says, maybe we got the translation wrong, and it was, Peter, you're dumb as a rock, but I'll still build my church on you, because he's always making mistakes, you know? But I'm sure, like, you know that it's God's grace and not Peter. If Peter ever, you know, started, like, thinking he was something, you know, he's walking around like, hey, I'm the rock of the church, I'm sure people are like, remember that day you cut the dude's ear off? stupid, you know? So I think, you know, he's got that grounding. So this story, that's why, you know, when in the church, I think, you know, we sometimes pretend that everybody's got to be perfect, and we have no grace even for each other sometimes, you know? And I one of my buddies, he's you know, kind of got some of those rough edges, and he's an urban youth pastor for a long time. He was an urban youth pastor, and he ended up taking a bunch of kids from the inner city to one of these festivals, and he was like, I wasn't sure if our kids were going to connect, you know, because, like, it's such a different world going from their world to these Christian conferences. He said, but I took them. He said, you got to hear the story. He sat me down. He said, on the way up there, we had a flat tire in the van, and he said, so I'm trying to change the tire, and it didn't fit. So he's like, it started raining on me, and just every one thing after another, he's like, something just snapped, and I started punching the van and cussing it out. I just lost it, and he said, all my kids are sitting inside looking at me. And he said, finally, we ended up figuring it all out. You know, they got somebody to come help them and everything, and they said they were late. You know, they go to the retreat. He said, it's real awkward. I get back in the van. All the kids are like, man, did you hear? That was crazy, man. That was messed up. You know, they go on up the retreat, and they get there. And he said, that night, like, one of my toughest kids, I mean, he'd been through everything. He ended up dedicating his life to Jesus at this retreat. And that late that night, they were sort of unpacking it a little bit. He's like, tell me about it, man. Was it something you heard in the message? Was it some of the singing? And the kid was like, no, man, it was on the way up there when I saw you lose it and start cussing the van out. And I thought, if Jesus can save you, Jesus can save me too. So I think there's something about a community that is able to create a place where we're honest, right? We're honest. I don't think that the world out there is looking for Christians that are perfect. I think they're looking for Christians that are honest. And for too long, we've kind of acted like we're perfect and pointed fingers at everybody else, and we have this sort of aura of self-righteousness. I love it. I was preaching at this church, and the greeters outside, instead of, you know, the suits and ties and stuff, they had t-shirts on that said "No perfect people allowed." That's a great greeter for every church, you know. No perfect people allowed. You're welcome here, as long as, you know, like, every time we're coming together, we're admitting that we need each other and we need God, that this is a story about grace, and we've got to create communities where grace can flourish, right? And where we can allow each other to thrive and even allow each other to fall sometimes. I like how old Rich Mullins, you know who that is, Rich Mullins? He was a beautiful singer and songwriter, died in a car crash it's right at 20 years ago. But he talked about how when we fall on the grace. He was always really honest with his mistakes. I'll tell you one Rich Mullins story. I got to know him a little bit before he died. And I guess I couldn't get to know him after he died, but I got to know him before he died. And there's this story where he and a buddy were riding on a train. And they're, you know, it's a long train ride, so they're kind of having a little bro down, and they're, you know, confessing some of their, you know, not greatest moments, and they're kind of talking to each other, and then the train sort of arrives, and they really had, you know, this real vulnerable time of sharing, and they get up, and there's a woman on the seat in front of them that, as they get up, she looks back and she says, "Pardon me, but I couldn't help but notice, you look like Rich Mullins. Are you Rich Mullins?" And he said, "I began to think, and it occurred to me, all the things that she might have heard me say, and I had to decide if I was Rich Mullins." And he said, I looked her in the eye, and I said, "Yes, yes, I am." And as I heard him say that, it was like this beautiful owning of who he was, you know, and I think that's what we need. You know, we need to know, though, I think first that we're loved, and the church is a place where I think we can, some of us, you know, we've been kind of told our whole life that we're crap, and we need to be reminded that we're beautiful. And other people, we've been told our whole life we're beautiful, and we need to remember that our stuff smells too, you know, like so I think that this is a place where we can all be reminded that we're beautiful, and we're all so broken. And So that's the grace that moves me, you know, and it's that grace that I think as we, the more we internalize that, the more you would think it makes us, you know, gracious people in the world. Some of the stories I've encountered as I've been doing death penalty work, there's some of the most horrific stories in the world, and yet people that have exchanged such evil with the power of God's love and mercy. Let me tell you one of the stories. I was finishing my book on grace and the death penalty, and I was in Minneapolis. I was speaking like this, and but before the event, they said, "You got to meet this woman. She is a legend of forgiveness and grace." And so they took me to meet this woman, Mary Johnson, on the north side of Minneapolis, and she's telling me her story. And her story, like many, you know, starts hard. Her son was just young teenage boy shot and killed on the north side of Minneapolis. And then as they caught the young man that did it, she obviously, as a mom, her only child, her only boy, she began to there was such anger, you know, such grief in her. She wanted the harshest punishment possible. And then she said, "But the Spirit started working on me, she had this. She's very sort of Pentecostal, and she said she had this experience where there was a poem that she read, and it was an anonymous poem. It's almost like it fell out of the sky, but she actually had a copy of it. She gave me, and it's this story of these two women, they kind of angelic figures in heaven, right? And they're talking to each other, and they can tell as they're talking to each other that each of them has a blue tint to their halo." And it means that they lost their child while they were here on earth. And so the one mother says, "Tell me about yourself." And she realizes as she's talking to the other mother that it's Mary, the mother of Jesus. And Mary says back to her, "Tell me about yourself." And she says, "I am Judas's mother, Judas Iscariot." And she said, "When I read that," this is Mary back in Minneapolis, she said, "I realize there's another mother and I need to get to know her." And she went and she got to know the mother, the other mother. And they created this community together. It's a support group. It's called Two Mothers. They got a support group for mothers who have lost their kids. And they have a support group for mothers whose kids have taken the lives of someone else. And they grieve together because they're all losing their kids in different ways. And she also, over time, began to build a relationship with O'Shea, with the young man who killed her son. And they have had this unbelievable transformation. And eventually he was released from prison. And it's absolutely amazing. As he was leaving jail, he said, "I feel like the luckiest man alive because I have two mothers to welcome me home." And he ended up being a next-door neighbor to Mary, the mother of the child that he had taken their life so many years earlier. And you look at that story, and I mean, it's moving Minneapolis. Now when there's a murder, they go together. And one of the mothers is taking care of the victims, and the others is taking care of the family who their son did the tragedy or their daughter did that. So they're a healing balm in that community, you know. And I think that's the power of God's love and grace to stir us to interact with evil without becoming it. And it's that which, you know, one of my other favorite grace stories is the story of the Amish as they responded to the shooting a couple hours from our house. Y'all remember that a few years ago? And I've gotten to know the family of Charlie Roberts. Charlie Roberts was, my understanding is he was actually the milkman for the community, and he had was struggling deeply, you know, mentally. And he went into the Amish school armed. He killed a bunch of the kids. And then he killed himself. But what moved the world, you may remember this, was the response of the Amish. It quickly went from just another mass shooting in America to this story of grace. The Amish went together to the family of the shooter, to Charlie's family, and they said, you must be really grieved. You know, you lost your dad, you lost your husband, and we wanted to make sure that you're not alone because we've got a really big community. and we're all able to take care of each other, but we wanted you to know that we're there for you. And Terry, the mother of the shooter, Charlie's mother, she talks about the power of seeing these Amish men hold her husband as he wept and wept. And a part of their healing has been this friendship between their families that, people began to pour out money to the Amish, and they took the money that was given to them and they created a scholarship fund for the children of Charlie Roberts. And then as the funerals rolled around, they went to the funeral of their own kids, but then they went to the funeral of Charlie Roberts, the Amish went, so that they could grieve the loss of their family. I mean, it moved the world. There's been books that were written on it now, Amish Grace, so many things. And listen to this, as I got to know Terry, one of the things that she said is that as they've developed this friendship, they do a lot of different things together, but one of the things that they do is she said, a part of my recovery from this has been visiting Rosanna. Rosanna is one of the little girls that was shot but survived, and her physical reality is totally different now. Her body doesn't work the same, but she says, I began to go regularly and visit Rosanna, and she says, years ago it was, feeding her and bathing her and singing with her, and now they still meet every other week, and she goes there and she visits her, and she says, no one's turning a blind eye to what happened. In fact, every time she goes and visits Rosanna, she's looking it in the face and remembering the horror of what her son was responsible for, but she says, grace gets the last word. And really what is everybody's remembering in that story is the healing and the power of love and grace and community in the face of such a horrific tragedy. It was in light of that that we wrote our book, Jesus for President, and we have a section called Amish for Homeland Security. You go, what if, we had that imagination after 9/11, sweet Jesus, how would the world be different? But, I think that we live in a world right now that is so starved for grace, so riddled with violence. And so one of the things that we've, I wanted to show you as we're going to open it up for dialogue in just a second, but we were really inspired by this verse of the early Christians when they said this verse that's from the prophets Micah and Isaiah. That says God's people will beat swords into plows and spears into pruning hooks. It's actually a verse that the early Christians, one after another, said, this is what we're doing in the world. Actually, this ancient prophecy is what the people of Jesus are fulfilling in the world, right? And it's beautiful because it ends by saying nation will not rise up against nation and people will study war no more. But it begins with the people of God refusing to kill, choosing a different way, standing on the side of life and transforming their weapons from instruments of death to life. So we got really excited by that. And we got our blacksmith friends and our welders and we started learning metal crafting. One of the things we've got going, I think I mentioned this earlier, is we got like 300 million guns in America. It's a problem. We got almost one for every person. And that's, where there's more guns, there's more gun deaths. And so we have, this epidemic of violence. So what we did was we got so inspired by this, we invited people to start donating their guns. Because we're like, people got to have a few extras. And so we got it's amazing what you can do with social media, Twitter and Facebook and stuff. We were like, you got any guns you want to donate? And people started donating them, right? So we had this dude that was like, I got an AK-47. Not sure why, you don't go hunting deer with it. And he's like, I can't imagine anything good coming from it, so I'd like to donate it. So this is what it looked like before, and this is what it looked like after. Booyah! Turn that thing into a shovel and a rake. And then we started getting images from, all over the world of guns that have been turned into guitars. And This one is this fellow in Mozambique that had taken it and turned it into a semi-automatic, into a saxophone that he played music on. And then one of my favorites is my friends in Iraq and Najaf. They said we want our kids to catch this vision of an Iraq free of war and violence. So they poured guns in the streets and they rolled over them with a steamroller, and they said we wanted the kids to drive, so we let them drive. Their parents were with them. Don't worry. But one of our it's just unbelievable, you know, as they crush those guns and we're all like kind of praying this same prayer of a world free of violence. And one of our last conversions that we did more recently was this one. We found this gun in an abandoned house in Philadelphia and we heated it up. But instead of just our blacksmith friends and our Mennonite welders and stuff, we invited the mothers and dads who had lost their kids. So this mother, she's got a picture of her son who was killed in a random, terrible shooting in Philadelphia. And she took the hammer and she started beating on this gun. And as she did it, with every thump of the hammer, she said, "This is for my boy." And she transformed it. And I mean, it was something transcendent, right? It felt like she was participating in the holy work of God, because she was. You know, it was a sacrament, and we saw it as we saw that metal transformed. And this is what we made that day out of the same barrel of that gun. And now we've seen those kind of all over. We've done public gun transformations all over the country, and we're able to, you know, now as we're building a community center or planting a garden, we're able to break the ground with what used to be the metal of a gun. And as I think of that verse, you know, of beating swords into plows, I think that's one of the beautiful vocations and callings that we have today in a world filled with violence. And so as we open it up now, listen to these words of Justin Martyr. This is 165 AD. 165 AD. He said this: "We ourselves were well conversant with war, murder, and everything evil. But all of us throughout the whole wide earth have traded in our weapons of war. We've exchanged our swords for plows, our spears for farm tools. We cultivate now the fear of God and justice, kindness, faith, and we cultivate the expectation of a future given to us through the crucified one, Jesus." Amen. Well, that's a lot to process, but I think it's an invitation to, you know, think about grace and think about nonviolence and what role we can play in kind of disarming our own hearts and disarming the world we live in. So we'll open it up as we did this morning. If you're new tonight, I've made a tradition now of trying to open up conversation as we so you don't just kind of come hear somebody talk and leave. So we'll open it up for a few minutes if anybody wants to share or respond, ask a question, share something that you see going on around you that resonates. Yeah. Yeah. The question about how we protect folks from people that are a danger to society. I think the interesting thing is that there's no doubt that there are people who are imminently dangerous. I think Dylan Roof is one of those who was responsible for the Charleston shooting. And yet after that, you also heard the victims say, not all the victims, but many of them say, we can do better than mirroring the very violence that he did to us, to him. You know, like there are ways, I think plenty of ways now in industrialized society that we can protect folks from an innocent person without killing that person, you know. Protect people from a violent person without killing that person. And in fact, I think that's part of why the Catholic position has become even more passionate on this. The Catholic position has for a long time been that we don't need the death penalty, but now it's even more firmly that there's no place for the death penalty in industrialized societies because we have other ways of protecting ourselves from violent people. I think that you guys, and there's a lot of other countries that have shown us better ways of dealing with folks that are dangerous than through execution. One of the other things I'd say is that there's sort of a myth behind this, too, that we're killing the worst of the worst. And that's actually not true, that in our country, we're not killing the worst of the worst. We're often killing the poorest of the poor. And what's more a determinant of who gets executed than the atrocity of a crime is the resources of the defendant to defend himself or herself. And there's many other things, too, like the race of the victim. When the victim is white and the person who is the defendant is a person of color, that equation overwhelmingly ends up equaling an execution. Whereas in some states like Florida, I was just in Florida, in 170 years, they've never had a white person executed for killing a person of color. Not because it hasn't happened, but because there's a certain framework for how we think about some of these things and who gets attention and who doesn't. Other folks? Anybody else want to share? It can be lingering thoughts from this morning, too, if you want. Or maybe you're just feeling peaceful tonight, which is okay, too. So we can close in a second if you want. But if you want to share anything, feel free. Yeah, way back in the back, and then I'll come up to you. Yeah. Absolutely both, and I think one of the problems is that a lot of the kind of stale rhetoric has been, we don't have a gun problem, we just have a heart problem. And the fact is, I think we have a gun problem and a heart problem, and it needs to be seen as both. You know, I think we need God to heal hearts, we need God to disarm hearts and teach us the ways of nonviolence, the fruits of the Spirit, all those beautiful things. But we also we just have guns everywhere. One of the young men I heard from the city said, he said, it's easier to get a gun in our neighborhood than it is a healthy salad. And he wasn't joking. He was, you know, I mean, there's, it's literally very, very easy to get guns. There's a lot of things that we're doing. There's a group of mayors against gun violence that have drafted a 10-point code of conduct that would decrease the amount of guns flowing into our streets. And some of that, I can talk to you more about the exact specifics, but like our biggest arms dealer in the country, Walmart, has signed on to that code of conduct, which we celebrate, you know, like that. I think that's one good move. We might critique a few other things, but, you know, but I think we're trying to move towards reducing that. There's kind of a policy side, one sensible law, I think, is that things like one handgun a month that would say we're not trying to take away the second, amendment, the right to bear arms, but we're saying 12 handguns a person is enough. Unfortunately, that law still can't pass because that's just to show you how strong the gun lobby is and how uncompromising it is that even to say, a person you know, 12 hand, one handgun a month. We can't even get sensible laws like that right now. So I think that it has to happen on all levels. And laws don't change hearts, but they do. They can make our streets a little bit safer. Some of the laws that we pass in Philly, like that we have, shouldn't have semi-automatics, like shouldn't have a gun that has the capacity to shoot 100 rounds in a minute. Like, it's insane. Like, but when we pass some laws, our state overturns them because of that, the gun lobby, you know. So there's just a whole lot of things more to be said about that. But there's the new data is showing that more and more people do not believe, these are gun owners and even NRA members, don't believe that owning a gun and public safety are can't be reconciled. They believe they can be reconciled. So, like, I think we're seeing some good movement. One of our best allies on the gun issue has been Hunters Against Gun Violence, and those are gun owners that are against gun violence, and that's been an amazing partnership. So, yeah, so we're writing a book on guns. We haven't really made that public, but we're writing a book on guns now called Beating Guns, that I'm doing with some other folks. So we're hoping to, like, dive, just as I did with the death penalty, we're going to dive into the gun thing. So you can be praying about that and looking. It'll be a while before we have that ready, but I'm researching. I read this whole book on the way over here about the history of guns called Gunning of America. It just blows the mind. But anyway. Yeah, if you're really interested, I can tell you more. It's like a 600-page book, so I won't go into all that, you know. So, other folks? Yeah, oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot to come back to you. The young lady behind you, now I'll come up to you. Racial tension was your question, being outside St. Louis. I mean, this, you know, the hot spot of Ferguson, and I've been there a couple of times. I think that, like, the beginning for, I think, is that we can't have reconciliation until we have truth, and we can't have healing until we have truth. And we haven't really told the truth, I think, in a lot of our communities about the history of slavery and the legacy that it's left us with. So I think we've got to begin by doing some real truth telling about our history. And that's true with the death penalty too. I mean, I think that, like, where lynchings were happening is also where executions are happening now. So we still have this deep, it's all over our country right now. It's, you know, impossible to miss that we need racial healing, but I think that begins with racial truth-telling, you know, and telling really some of, and talking with each other, leaning in and listening, particularly to the voices of color right now that are, so I think some of that can start with on social media, but it really, I think it's got to take us into real-time relationships too, where we can begin to see through each other's eyes. Because what's really clear to me in our country is that we're seeing through two different lenses, you know. And I know that because I grew up with one lens, which was, you know, East Tennessee. Every police officer was a hero. And I heard a lot of true stories about police officers that were heroes. They were true stories. But then I moved to Philly, and I see a whole another side. I mean, some, like I said earlier, you know, some of our hardest stories have been with police. We've got an absolute policing crisis in America. There's no doubt, I think. If you ask white folks, do we have a policing crisis, like 80% of them say no. If you ask people of color, like 80% of them say yes, you know. So I think we're seeing through two different lenses, and we've got to begin to talk to each other, and particularly as white folks, I think we've got to really listen to the pain of other folks and right now. So yeah, you could be for sure praying with us. And since you're going back to St. Louis, we got a lot of friends. Tracy Blackman, if I was in your area, I'd be, you know, trying to meet up with her any chance I could. And I think for a lot of us that have been a part of the dominant white culture, we need to deliberately place ourselves in communities where we are a minority, and practice at that. It won't be long before we, you know, are a minority, but I think, like, we have to be deliberate about submitting ourselves to leaders of color, worshiping in places where it's not a majority white population, things like that. So I'd keep leaning into that. And then there's communities like CCDA, if you haven't seen it, because you're in the States, and others of you too, a lot of the resources are online for free. The Christian Community Development Association, one of the core pillars is racial reconciliation. And it's led by a 85-year-old African-American legend in our country who was the son of a sharecropper. His brother was killed by police officers in the South and civil rights movement, Dr. John Perkins. And he's also a person with such grace that he heard about this former dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, one of the big leaders of the KKK that had a really converted heart and changed heart. And he had given his life to Jesus. And John found him, hunted him down, and said, we need to get to know each other. And they end up writing a book together called He Is My Brother. It's how God's heart is, you know, God's grace is big enough to change the heart of a Klansman. So, yeah. I saw you, and then we'll come to you, okay? Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, well, I don't think that nonviolence means that we have no discernment, you know, or that we're not wise. But I think that that part of what we've learned is that there's a way to create what Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker said. We've got to create an environment where it's easier to be good. You know, where we're moving each other towards that. So I think that takes deliberation, it takes structure, it takes prayer, it takes all of these different things. You know, we got to cultivate a space of nonviolence, especially when we're surrounded by violence all the time. But because we're working those muscles, I find that we end up, we have a bigger imagination in community. And so, like, for instance, at one point we had taken in a woman coming out of domestic violence, and she had shared custody with her husband or the kid's dad at the time. And so she had to deliver the kids to the police station where they would exchange, but the kid's dad would head her off and he was abusive. And so he would catch her before she got to the police station. So we're like, what do we do with this situation? Well, instinctively, a lot of the men were like, we'll accompany her. You know, so we ended up walking with her, and as soon as he saw us, he snapped, and he got defensive and violent, you know, like, so it was like, that didn't work, you know, so we come back, and the women are like, so we're praying about this thing about it, and the women are like, okay, listen, you're still thinking from the machismo, you're trying to fight, you know, fire with fire, like, let's just have a bunch of women go with her, and so they had a bunch of women accompany her, and when he met them, it was a totally different thing. He was disarmed. I mean, he's not ready to fight a bunch of women. And so I think sometimes we've just got to train our minds differently and allow the Spirit to train us. But there's also a wisdom and I think a safety that comes in the context of community. And I mean, we were able to create some safe places. I mean, we're not guaranteed that we're going to be safe, period, you know, and I think as we look at our country, like, some of the most dangerous people right now, I truly believe, are white supremacists, and then if you look at some of our biggest mass shootings, some of our angriest rhetoric, folks that take over buildings like in Oregon, I mean, they've been white folks with guns, so I think those are not the ones that get the airtime, but I think they're certainly some of the most dangerous people in our country. And so, you know, I think the way that we disarm that, though, is kind of on all levels. I think it's by creating these alternative communities where, I think when Jesus says there's greater love is no one than this than to lay down their life for another, like, what we can do in any situation is put ourselves in a place where we are in solidarity with someone who's vulnerable. I think that when we try to use violence to counteract violence, that we end up often perpetuating the very thing we're trying to get rid of. And like criminologists kind of that have studied the brain, they also talk about this, that someone that's trying to do violence or even a crime, like rob a house, they're usually, our minds are conditioned for two responses, fight or flight. They're ready for you to fight them, or they're ready for you to try to run. But when you do something other than that, it throws the brain off, and it throws, I think, the whole system off. So we've actually seen that happen in instances in our community. Just, I mean, one more little quick story was one of the young women. She's very small and petite, but she's spitfire, and you don't mess with her. And she's from Brazil, and she was on the train, and this dude pulled a knife on her, and he was like, "All right, here's the deal. You're going to give me your bag and get off at the next stop and not say anything." And Lydia was, I mean, she's fearless. And so she said, "I don't know what you want in my bag." And she said, "It's got all the pictures of my family and addresses. I'm from Brazil. And I need all my family's addresses. And they're not going to mean anything to you. There's no money in my bag." And she said, I would imagine you want money. And she said, "So I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. I got $20 in my pocket. I'm going to get it out, give it to you, and you're going to get off at the next stop and not say anything." And exactly what happened. You know, so I think we need to be fearless, but I think that there are ways that we can interact that give that sort of third way of Jesus. It's neither hunkering down in fear, nor is it, you know, replicating the violence that's being shown to us. One or two more. Yeah, great. Oh, right, Chicago. Yeah, great. Well, so I think there is the spiritual side of this, I think, where we can create really beautiful redemptive spaces. I think examples of that are like the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that have happened, you know, in South Africa and Rwanda and other places. I think in one of the congregations I'm a part of, we have a police officer that wanted to have a similar type meeting. So they said, "Let's get some folks from the, especially the kids, you know, the youth, the young people, and some police officers. Let's get in the same room together and talk to each other." And they did that. And it was pretty amazing because they started off just by saying to the kids, "What are some of the things that police officers do for us?" And they didn't know what they were going to hear. But the first things they started saying is, "They beat down our door. Or they take my mom. You know, like, they scare me." And the kids told the truth. And these police officers stand there listening to it. And in that moment, I think, like, truth begins to set us free. Like, there was some real healing that began to happen. And there's similar meetings that have now happened in Newark and some other places in the U.S. And my friend was just telling me, it may have been Trenton, it was in New Jersey. So they were having these community and policing meetings led by clergy. So they were kind of creating kind of a holy, safe place. And the first thing that the police department decided to do on their own was they decided to have a statement of historic harm, of some of the things that they have done in the community that need to be, like, named. And that was their takeaway from that. And that was the first thing that happened. And now they're moving, you know, out of that. But one of the problems that you kind of identify, I don't know what it's like, you know, here in Australia, but is that our police are policed by police. When we've seen very clear cases of police misconduct, we've seen one guy that was arrested in the snow. The police took one of his shoes and they threw it over a fence. So when he got out of jail and had to get home, he'd be barefoot on one foot, you know. And we saw another police officer that ran into a car and broke a kid's leg. And, like, we've just seen those. So there's very clear instances. But when we've gone to file cases of police misconduct, they come back unfounded, you know. So I think we need a whole new way of doing that. And we, you know, not everybody's from Chicago or Philly, but we could talk more about that. I think we also need a whole new training of our police, and we need One of the things in Obama's task force that they walked away with was saying we need an emergency response unit of social workers that are trained in mental illness, that are trained in de-escalation, so that police can't be everything. And one of the officers told us in the academy they only get like one day in mental health, so they're not really equipped to deal with a lot of the things that they're coming into. So I think we can do a lot better job training them. Yeah, one of the police officers told me what they do in Philly is everybody's sent to my neighborhood in Kensington because it's kind of like the training ground. They said you see everything in Kensington, so it's where you go to cut your teeth. Well, that means we're getting folks that are straight out of the academy that are coming to our neighborhood. Some of them have never even been a minority as a white person coming into our neighborhood. There's all kinds of problems that come out of that. And she said, and when people do well, by the time they begin any street rapport, you know, or credibility in the neighborhood, they're transferred out of Kensington, out of my neighborhood. So I think there's a whole lot of different things we need to do to, it's generally just really hard to police a neighborhood if you don't respect it. And it's hard to respect a neighborhood, too, if you don't live in it and you don't see, you know, the good and the bad in it. So, yeah. Anybody else? Other folks? We're talking a little heavy on the U.S. side, so feel free to switch this off, but yeah. Yeah, well, thanks. That's sweet. What do we do with exhaustion? I guess a couple of things I'd say about, you know, exhaustion or burnout. One of them is we try to take care of ourselves. We have things like a Sabbath day. Crazy idea, you know, like take a day off, you know, you know, where we rest or we play, we do things that give us life, you know, and I try to integrate my life too to where I'm like, I have a certain amount of days that I travel in a month, and I find that if I travel more than 10 days, I start to feel like a little homesick and like I'm talking about stuff we're doing but not doing what we're doing, you know. And on the other hand, when I'm in my neighborhood, I've got a fire in my bones. I'm an evangelist. I like to get out and talk, so I find that I need to be doing those. You know, when I'm writing, I like to get in the garden and get dirt under my fingernails. You know, like I try to integrate my life, and that helps a lot. The other thing that helps is working on a macro level at the same time that we're working on a grassroots level. And so if all I was doing was giving away food every day, I'd start to get tired if I wasn't doing something about why people are hungry to begin with, you know? But on the other hand, I think, like, I've got a lot of friends working in D.C. God bless them, you know, they're like working on legislative policy changes, and frankly, I think that sometimes they do well to like come have a snowball fight, you know, and like play in a fire hydrant and like sit on the stoop and hold somebody, you know, as they cried, because there needs to be a human, you know, relational connection to that. So those keep me pretty energized. And people are doing what they love too. Like we're a big believers that, you know, if folks don't like kids, we're not going to put them in the after school program. Like we need to be operating out of our passions and our joys, and community helps too. Like you hear me talking a lot about community because it's how we carry the weight of things too. With Jesus, of course, Jesus helps carry the weight of the world. But we also, like, when someone comes home and they're like, Pedro's dad beat him up again. Like, everybody kind of carries that together, and I think we also have everybody's imagination trying to work together to make sure that doesn't keep happening. But, yeah, community helps, you know, keep that alive. It's also fun. Like, we have a lot of fun. Social justice people can be way too serious, I find, you know, and we're dealing with, like, really heavy stuff in our country right now, so we tend to, like, keep amping up our one of my hardest times was when I got home from Iraq after the war. I'd been over there on a peace delegation, saw really, really horrible things. And I got home and I fell asleep. I was really tired. And my housemates hung this life-size picture of George Bush above my bed. And that was like one of my favorite pranks, because I woke up. I think they stayed up all night, because like when I woke up, they're watching me. And I'm like, oh, God! You know, he's on top of me. And I left it there. So I slept with George Bush above me for a long, long time. And I prayed for him every night. And but it also, like, you know, kept me a little bit lighter. And I think we need to keep each other a little lighter, because we know the end of the story. You know, we know that mercy triumphs over judgment. You know, the tomb is empty, and love is more powerful than hatred, even when it doesn't feel like that every day. Does that feel good? Thanks so much. I know you have a lot of things you could do on a Saturday night, but it's beautiful to be in this space together, and an honor to be able to share. So see some of you tomorrow morning, or I'll hang out tonight too. So thanks. Do we need to do anything else?
Thanks, Shane. That's it for tonight. We're back tomorrow morning. We're back here. If you're from West City, we'll be here. Don't go to the church. We won't be there. I know a lot of you have churches of your own. If you are able to come and experience the last session we have tomorrow, I think it'll be a really valuable time. But I've been informed that we have tea, we have coffee, and there may be even biscuits, and we don't have a curfew, apparently. So we can... you know, we're like to like 9:30, you know, like we go wild. I'm sure you have a lot of questions and conversations to be had, so why don't we go and